Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello, I'm Gab Marcotti, and welcome to The Game, the football supplement from The Times in audio form, in case you hadn't figured it out. Joining me today are Clive Petty, Matt Hughes, and a special guest from the US of A, largely because David Beckham was not available. It's our old buddy, Tom Dart. Later on, we'll be discussing the rise of MLS and David Beckham's part in that. But we start with another eventful weekend in the Premier League. All right, Reading and Manchester United. Clive, you're a purist. You're joking. You're not a purist. You don't see yourself that way. Anyway, 7 goals in the first half. Is this good or just terrible? Assuming you're above the age of 8.
It kind of depends what your standpoint is, I guess. If you're a Reading fan on Saturday, 7 goals would have been graced up, I suppose, and you would have thought, we've scored 3 times against, you know, Manchester United.
They could have conceded 5, Husey, right? I mean, this is bad, good?
I know, it's good. You know, as Clive says, if you're a Reading fan, you've probably got more out of the game than you would have expected. If you're a United fan, you've got 3 points. If you're a neutral, you've seen a great game of football. So what are we moaning about? Obviously, if you're...
A great game of football?
Great 32 minutes.
What is one defensive mistake after another? And I'm talking at both ends here, because I think Reading's defending was terrible as well.
Well, if you didn't want to watch that, you should have just watched the rerun of the 2003 Champions League final, you know. I mean, what do we want? We watch football to see goals and entertainment and skill. Obviously, mistakes facilitate that, but I don't think we should be...
You saw a lot of skill in that game?
Yeah, I saw Michael Carrick play some good balls. I saw Van Persie score good goals. I saw Anderson running inside the channels. Obviously, defending from set pieces was pretty average, but... You know, most people would rather watch that than a 0-0 draw.
Tom, help me out here. Can you explain to Husey why he's wrong?
He's not wrong, is he? The only thing about this game that's disappointing. The only thing that's disappointing about this game is the second half. You know, after 7 goals in the first half, you kind of feel a bit cheated that you don't get another 7 in the second half. You know, I hate these games where they're so good in the first half, then halftime comes and you're really buzzing and you're looking forward to the second half, and it's a bit of a letdown. It's kind of the wrong way around, but it's good to be talking about football after all the Premier League's issues off the pitch. It's good to be discussing goals, you know.
I don't think it's good to be discussing these goals, and I think y'all are absolutely insane to think that this is good. Because I say this because I know Manchester United can play a lot better, and I suspect Reading can play better as well. And you know, but hey, that's just me. Let's move on from that. I accept I'm in the minority. Your country, your game, your rules. Clive, I want to get to you. Much was made when he takes off Rafael after half an hour. I presume it's maybe partly because he got skinned, partly because Evans made some horrible mistakes too, but I guess Rafael's smaller than Evans and they were worried about set pieces and whatever. Psychologically, we don't really see that often. I'm guessing Sir Alex has a lot of faith in Rafael's ability to bounce back and this won't totally crush him?
Yeah, I hope so, yeah. I mean, it can be. I can understand his frustration when he walked. I mean, nobody, after half an hour, especially when, as you say, you've been skinned, your team has let in. I can't remember whether it was after the 2 or 3 goals now when he went off, but he's obviously taking it as a sort of, hey, the manager's hanging me out as I'm the one to blame here.
That's exactly what happened, though, right? I mean, he wouldn't have substituted him if he thought, it's not Rafael's fault. We're doing great with him.
But he perhaps can take him off because in order to making that change, he can bring somebody else on to facilitate a change around the rest of the back four. In that, I think it was Smalling who came on, wasn't it? So Smalling can come into the middle and you can move Evans, as you say, he's a bit bigger, perhaps. I'm not quite sure what happened, but you can make a change without actually saying it's specifically that guy's fault if you want to change your system. But that doesn't help the player, I must admit. At the time, I can understand Rafael, young, impetuous. He sees it as, my God, I'm being blamed for the frailties of the entire back four here in front of, only 20,000 people at Reading, but you know what I mean. So I can understand the sort of frustration of the player. But, as long as afterwards, we don't know what happens afterwards, back in the dressing room, back at Old Trafford, that's down to what Fergie now tells him and says, look, we needed to do that for the sake of that game. Nothing on you, just that. It was just that half an hour. Get over it, come back, work hard, do it, get yourself back in the team.
Excuse me, one thing I want to ask you about, and I'll throw this out to everybody if you guys saw this. Rafael goes off, there's the bit with the coat. But then there's this guy, I'm assuming it's a kit man or some kind of servant for United, who picks up the coat and kind of throws it over Rafael's head as he's walking off. Did you guys see this?
Yeah, that was Albert the kit man, wasn't it?
What kind of a zoo did he escape from? I mean, I just thought, can you be any sort of more disrespectful and... And I mean, I'm sorry. I hope that he's like Raphael's dad, and they've got some kind of special relationship where he can go and do this. But I imagine if that had been Joey Barton, or in fact, not even Joey Barton, a normal, less patient footballer, would have turned around and nutted him, right?
I think he's sort of one of Fergie's enforcers, and he was probably acting on behalf of the manager, get back in your box sort of thing. But if you were a bigger name player, you certainly wouldn't have...
You think Fergie told this guy?
No, he wouldn't have told him to, but he's this kit man is quite sort of old school. He would certainly side with the manager as opposed to any player in any potential confrontation. So I'm sure he was acting for his own bat, but it did look a bit, it looked like he should have been bundling him out of a nightclub.
Exactly.
Quite heavy-handed stewarding, as they say.
Does Albert have a last name too, or is he like Madonna or Liberace?
I think he does, but I don't know it.
All right. Just curious here. Now, I want to have a word on United's defending and in general, because one of the things that struck me was we seem to see this. I was watching on television. You've got Jason Roberts and then Evra and then the goalkeeper, Lindegaard. And it's the kind of thing where, like, Roberts is, like, leaning into Evra and the referee sees it and they're going. And every time he goes and pushes. And I'm just wondering, Tom, since Allison's not here, you're the closest that we have to a proper referee. I don't understand.
Not very close.
But closer than the rest of us. But if you see this happening, why not go and just book somebody? Because the minute the guy looked away, they did it again.
I can't explain what was going through Mark Halsey's mind, but...
Few people can. Well, then riddle me this.
It's up to the players. It's up to the players to draw attention to... to him at every occasion when that happens and really get in his face and remind him of it so he's looking for it.
You know what was bizarre about that is I was talking to a Premier League goalkeeper last night. You can guess which one. And he made the point that in those situations, right, when they send the striker up and then basically to disturb the goalkeeper, if you defend it by putting a defender between striker and goalkeeper and the two push each other, unless you've got a very big, strong defender who can manhandle the striker, which obviously Evra isn't, what's going to happen is the striker will push the defender into the goalkeeper. The easy way to deal with it is just put your defender in front of the striker. Because obviously, if Roberts goes and pushes the goalkeeper the way he pushed Evra, it will be a foul every single time. And this seemed pretty basic to me, and I'm wondering if... I know goalkeepers in United, except for the Schmeichel and Van der Sar eras, have always been an issue. But I'm wondering, Clive, should it have been Lindegaard's job or Evra, since he was senior player to kind of not defend in this idiotic way.
I kind of guess it.
Especially if the referee is letting Roberts just kind of like bulldoze Evra into Lindegaard.
A goalkeeper should be taking, I tend to think a goalkeeper should be taking command of his 6-yard area there. That's his space. And to be honest, I don't think goalkeeper's get enough protection anyway. There's nothing to say. If Roberts finds a space and stands there, and stands his ground, there's nothing. Why the hell should he move? You know, it's up to Lindegaard.
He's pushing Evra into, because the referee is allowing him to push Evra into Lindegaard.
Well, then, as you say, the referee's allowing that. You know, that's down to the referee. I mean, if you start giving that, nothing stops. It's that same old argument of shirt pulling or whatever. Everyone says, well, you know, there seems to be this argument that if you give every incident of this, or there'll be loads of penalties every week, or free kicks every week. Well, it's a foul, isn't it? That's what, and the punishment for a foul is a free kick or a penalty. You're supposed to give them. It's down to the referee. You know, what do you want? If Roberts is pushing Evra and it's deemed a foul, that's a foul. If Lindegaard doesn't want Evra standing there, I presume he wants Evra standing there.
To protect him from big bad Jason Roberts.
I presume so. And if it's getting in the way, then Lindegaard's got to say, no, look, I can handle myself. It's my 6-yard box.
Hughie, can you explain something else about the United goalkeeper situation? So they spent a lot of money on De Gea. In fact, I believe they make him the second most expensive goalkeeper in the history of the universe. He has a rough start at the season. Fergie sticks with him. This year, I thought he was actually playing pretty well. And now it seems that we have this sort of revolving door goalkeeping situation between him and Lindegaard, which I could kind of see the logic if Lindegaard were Brad Friedel, you know, some sort of wise old guy who's going to be out of the way soon. But Lindegaard isn't. Lindegaard's, what, 27, 28 years old? And he's also not that good. What's going on with De Gea? Why won't he play De Gea?
No, I agree with you. It doesn't make a great deal of sense. De Gea has been getting better, and from what I've seen, Lindegaard's been getting a bit worse. He was certainly pretty jittery at the weekend, and as you say, he's only, what, 5 years older, so he hasn't got that much more first-team experience because he's been, you know, been at White United large on the bench. So, yeah, it doesn't make a great deal of sense. I can only assume that De Gea hasn't shown up in training. Fergie sort of questioned his temperament and maturity before. Maybe he thinks he's not quite ready and is handpicking his games.
Tom, word on Reading, because I was kind of shocked at the way they came up last year. I've seen them play this year. I actually think that, at least from what I have seen, and Reading fans, please don't jump all over me, but man for man, I think they are the worst team in the Premier League by some margin. I know QPR have fewer points, and I know that there's other sort of stinky teams near the bottom. Am I completely wrong on this? Am I being too hard? Have they actually maybe done better than expected by the fact that they're not bottom and actually, you know, are, what, double figures in points or close to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. If you look at the look at their lineup, it is a championship lineup. How many players, when you look at, you know, yeah, Jason Roberts obviously has Premier League experience. Federici.
Is terrible. Let's not go there.
Is, yes, exactly. McEnough is always one of these players who's kind of borderline Premier League quality. Nicky Shorey.
Pogrebniak.
He's done not bad. He's got 5 goals. Lafondre is a good story. We've got 4 goals, respectable. You do have to say that it's not a huge surprise that if anyone wants in the league this season with a lineup that is going to battle hard and try and all these cliches, but just doesn't have the quality to stay up, I would think. So I think they've done well to get to have to have 9 points at this stage.
Hughie, in light of this, I mean, you're close personal friends with Zingarevich, the Russian oligarch who, of course, bankrolls Reading. Why has he not put more money in, or is he just kind of happy to have, you know, Reading work with somewhat limited resources, and and he's got no intention of being kind of like a mini Abramovich?
No, he hasn't, but I think they are going to spend some money in January. There's suggestions of a bid for Arshavin, which you could argue would be wasting a lot of money, although he tends to play quite well when he moves to clubs and then sit and take the money. I think McDermott wanted to give the players who got up a chance, to be honest, and so far he's done that with mixed results, but I do expect some reinforcements in January, and they're going to need them.
Moving east from Reading to Upton Park, which I believe is maybe what, a journey that's maybe what, 45 miles, 50 miles, yeah, but probably takes you several days in, on days like this one when it's raining and everybody forgets how to drive. But West Ham, can we show them some respect and go beyond the, oh, Big Sam lumping big balls to the big man up front? They're right up there in the table. I mean, he spent some money, but he's obviously spent it wisely. Clive, you were arguing recently that Sam Allardyce was the greatest manager England has produced in the last 30 years. No, just kidding.
How many drinks did I have when I said that?
No, hey, Clive, is there more to West Ham than lumping balls? Hey, there's actually an organization, and you know, they go and in the second half they showed a lot of spirit and
yeah, there is
they
more,
the
there
European
is,
champion.
There is more to West Ham than that, yes. But I mean, ironically, I think actually it may well have been the lumping balls to the big man that actually turned this game around, as far as I can see. You know, it was the high balls to the likes of Cole and the knockdowns that kind of worked. But yeah, it is harsh to, having watched them, seen them a few times this season, it is harsh to just say they are a straight long ball direct team. There is more to them. I mean, Nolan gets forward quite a lot and is quite pivotal to that team. And the work that Noble does, it's pointless having those players if you are just going to lump balls forward. It was a strange turnaround in that game, though, it has to be said, because Chelsea was so much on top in the first half. It's hard to think that just one sort of tactical switch of just getting behind and getting those balls to the big men was enough to outdo a team that is the European champions. I think that's quite worrying from their point of view. I don't think West Ham did anything particularly. They didn't come up with some mind-boggling plan and managerial brilliance from Allardyce to win that game. And then that's, you know, not taking anything away from West Ham, but it certainly would worry me if I was Chelsea.
Hey, Tom, was it? Did you agree with Clive? Was it a case of just West Ham being, Chelsea just being good at first and then terrible, and really West Ham had nothing to do with it or little to do with it?
I think it was a case of West Ham sensing Chelsea's vulnerability in the second half and making the most of it with a couple of decent finishes, and also Mata hitting the post with a free kick that, you know, had that been a couple of inches the other way, the game could well have turned out very differently. I think got to give West Ham credit because they did go behind and did come back. They weren't cowed or steamrolled by Chelsea after that. And not that West Ham were fantastic, but they did enough to take advantage of Chelsea's struggles. And I think that comes with a certain degree of confidence that comes from Allardyce picking solid players and managing them well.
This doesn't look like a Rafa Benitez team. I mean, I think even people who hate him would recognize that certainly at Valencia and at Liverpool, admittedly less so at Inter, you know, this was the kind of team that had two solid center backs, solid defensive midfield. I mean, you think back, you know, people who knew how to administer leads and hit on the counter if they needed to, and knew how to slow the game down. I'm thinking, you know, Xabi Alonso, of course, and Gerrard and Mascherano, and you know, that great Hupia-Carragher partnership. This Chelsea team in the second half, they didn't know how to really do that at all. And Rafa came out and said, well, it would have been better if we were 2 or 3 nil up. It would have been easier to protect the lead. And I kind of feel like, oh, yeah, really, Rafa? Is this just because he hasn't had time to work with these guys, or are they not suited to playing that way?
Well, the bottom line is we don't know, and we may never know, because he may never get the time because he's the manager of Chelsea and they just don't get time. I think you make a very good point. It's not Rafa's team, and it could never be Rafa's team. He's had 3 games, maybe 10 training sessions to work with them, and he can't, you know, drill them, discipline them, school them in the rigorous manner that he would like over that period. Rory Smith made a good point in the Times just in the game this morning. He was at the game on Saturday. He was pointing out that when these players have had so many managers over the last, whatever, 5 years, 2 years, they're not really anyone's team. They don't know what they're doing. I mean, a lot of them came from under Mourinho, and then they've had Grant and Scolari and Hinnick and Ancelotti and Di Matteo and Villas-Boas, and every 6 months, it seems, there's a sort of sea change in the way that the manager Reed, the owner, wants the club to play under Di Matteo. They were defensive last year, then they've become free-flowing and attacking. Now they scored too many goals. They conceded too many goals, so they're trying to go back the other way. And they're confused, right? I don't think they know what they're doing. And it's going to take a long time for them to develop a coherent game plan. And all that goes down, can be traced back to sort of the trigger-happy tendencies of the owner and his incredible lack of patience.
Tom, but the good news is that Rafa could be getting some help. There's reports today that Avram Grant is on standby and he could come in to help.
Yeah, Rafa must be absolutely thrilled. You know, as a coach who's won the Champions League, I'm sure he's really going to appreciate the help of a guy who got West Ham relegated.
All right, I got to jump in here, okay? I appreciate it's open season on Avram Grant, and we all have to make fun of the guy always and everywhere. But, yeah, Rafa won a Champions League on penalties. Avram Grant came within a penalty kick of winning a Champions League. Avram Grant took over a team that your god Mourinho had in sixth place and took it up to second place. Avram Grant took Portsmouth to an FA Cup final, right? Is Avram Grant all bad and and incompetent?
Was that Avram or basically the players? You know, I didn't really see Avram do much managing other than just picking.
Oh, come on. How much managing do you see Sir Alex do? Do you attend his training sessions? Or, sorry, Dominic Kinnear in your case?
Sometimes Dominic Kinnear, I do, yeah. Now and again. I think this is an extraordinary story and would be ridiculous if it happens, because then you're kind of adding another manager to Chelsea, you know.
But what if he's just there to be the owner's eyes and ears and just spy on the work Rafa's doing? Wouldn't that be beneficial?
That just makes it worse.
But Rafa's not paranoid at all, right? He's such a well-adjusted, confident man that...
It's great. At his unveiling 11 days ago, Rafa claimed that working for Roman would be easy compared to working with Hicks and Gillette, and because he was answering to one man and there's no conflict and he knew exactly what his job is. After three games, if you're already talking about having Avram sat on his shoulder, it's absolutely extraordinary. I don't think it will happen. I think Avram could come in, but if he does, it will be as a replacement for Benitez, not as a helper, unwanted or otherwise. You can't make it up, really. What a club and what a management structure. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Matt, you cover Chelsea quite closely. You speak to these people, the Tenenbaums and Schwidlers and Emanalos and, you know, this whole cloud of people. I don't know, is Pete De Visser still with us, or has he moved on?
He didn't seem to be as influential as he was, and he certainly isn't involved in managerial training. He's even more scouts the players.
Now, all these people, right?
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Who surround him. And I'm leaving Bruce Buck out of it because I don't think Bruce Buck offers Roman any advice on football, though maybe he should because he's been a season ticket holder at Chelsea for 30-odd years and has seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. But Can you tell us? Can you have any insight on how this works? Does he still text Mourinho for advice?
He's certainly in contact with Mourinho, but I don't think their relationship is as friendly as some claim, and I don't buy the theory that he will one day make a glorious return to Stamford Bridge. Abramovich, it's hard to explain, it's hard to understand, but there is no real formal management structure that you would get at a normal football club or any other big company. He sort of takes advice from various friends, confidants, advisors, as and when he sees fit. And the problem with all these kind of shadowy courtiers is they tend to tell him what he wants to hear. Advice is compromised. The people he seems to be close to at the moment are Eugene Tenenbaum, who is one of his oldest business associates, stroke friends. They go, they go back 20 years to the Soviet days. And then, interestingly, Michael Emanalo seems to have made himself indispensable. Michael Emanalo, former Nigerian international, no management coaching experience to speak of, other than in briefly working for a girls' team in Tucson in the States. But he was brought to Chelsea by Avram Grant, and has managed to kind of stick it out ever since. They're missing a link between the manager and Roman on the board, and that's a big problem, because he's not getting good advice, is he? He's not making good decisions.
I just have a quick yay or nay. Clive, you're very impartial on this one. More likely to be in the Champions League next season, Chelsea or Spurs?
At this moment in time, I'd like to say Tottenham. I really would like to say Tottenham. They for once in a while, they just seem to be a bit more stable, even with AVB in control.
Okay, that's enough Tottenham talk for the show. a yay or nay question, Tom?
Yay, the revenge of AVB.
Hughesy?
I say Chelsea for the simple reason that whether it's Dodger Lasagna or Barnett winning the Champions League, Spurs will always find a way to cock it up.
on that note, just one final thing from you, Hughesy. Chelsea are not mathematically out of the Champions League if Shakhtar Donetsk and Juventus don't agree to an almighty stitch-up and Lucescu beats the Italian side. Lucescu, of course, who lived in Italy and speaks Italian, has a home in Italy. And Chelsea pummel Nordsjælland. Chelsea could go through. That can happen?
It could happen. Shakhtar at home, very, very good side. I expect Chelsea to beat Nordsjælland at home. And then it's just up over to the game in Donetsk, and Shakhtar could win that, and they've got an incentive. They'll want to win the group.
Why? Why would you want to win the group? And wouldn't you rather knock Chelsea out than win the group?
I don't know. Not the current Chelsea. You'd probably rather play Chelsea than Juventus.
Yeah. Also, if they draw the game, if they draw, they win the group anyway, right?
Yeah, you're right. Actually, aren't you? I don't know. Well, they might win.
All right, thank you. All right, we didn't just have Tom Dart on because he's one of our favorite past contributors, but we also had him on because David Beckham ended his 5 years and change long stint in MLS by helping the Los Angeles Galaxy win the second MLS Cup of his tenure. It's a 3-1 win over the Houston Dynamo. Tom, I'm assuming, I don't know, maybe I'm the only saddo who watched this game, even though it was up against the Madrid derby and match of the day as well, and Phil Neville. But I don't want to talk too much about the game, but one thing that struck me was interesting was a score 2-1 up. LA get a penalty. It's a chance to put the game away. It's so late in the game. Houston kind of, I didn't think it was that good anyway, and I don't like the way Kinnear plays. But and yet, it's not Beckham who takes the penalty; it's Robbie Keane. Robbie Keane won the penalty, incidentally. Did that surprise you?
It did surprise me because Beckham appeared to be kind of walking into the penalty area and kind of lurking, waiting to see if Robbie Keane was going to say, "Here you go, Bex. You take it. You have the iconic moment to end the game, and you go off, sprinting and towards the crowd, cheering, celebrating the goal." So, but Robbie Keane didn't look at Beckham and didn't appear to have any interest in giving up the penalty.
Maybe he didn't know it was Beckham's last game. Is that possible?
Everyone outside America knew it was Beckham's last game, at least. I'm not sure in America. But Beckham said afterwards that he actually himself had no intention of taking it, and he was happy for Keane to take it. And he discussed it with Landon Donovan, who was too tired to take it. Beckham is at least sticking to the line that he didn't want to take it. It would have been nice, but Keane has been in great form lately, so it's not surprising that he himself wanted to cap an excellent season for him with the crowning glory of a last-minute penalty.
Now, Tom, much was made of when he came over. I think there were some, frankly, absurd premises, like the idea that he was going to make $50 million a year, something which I think we in the media were all pretty remiss at not calling them on that and sort of believing this lie, which had just been made up. And he was supposed to be the Messiah who elevated MLS. There was a moment when I think he was genuinely disliked by a number of people. But all told, MLS has made huge strides in the last 5 years, probably football in general, hasn't it? And how much of that's down to Beckham?
It's hard to quantify absolutely how much is down to Beckham. Clearly, the LA Galaxy themselves have benefited hugely from Beckham in terms of getting a much better TV deal, much better international exposure, more shirt sales, of course. The league has benefited because you have players of the caliber of Thierry Henry coming to New York. You have Beckham probably going to be replaced by Kaká in LA. It's now a more credible destination for, still over 30 players who are towards the end of their career, but at least, very much elite aging players. How much benefit has this had to, the Columbus Crew or the Vancouver Whitecaps? Usually when Beckham goes to away games, they sell out, so there's a bit of benefit there. There's a bit more credibility. Overall, MLS has grown from 12 teams 5 or 6 years ago to 19, and so crowds have gone up, but it still doesn't have the penetration. There's a rising number of people who care a lot about it, but that number is still relatively small when you think of America being a country of more than 310 million people. And although LA has now got an improved TV deal, overall the TV deal for the league is $10 million each year, which is about £6.5 million a year for national TV rights for MLS, which is paltry and way below the Premier League rights, which have just been signed. So
it's about one-eighth of the Premier League rights.
Exactly. So the LA Dodgers themselves, their TV rights are going to be worth, you're talking billions of dollars just locally. And until you have that TV rights explosion, when TV rights go up and up and up, MLS can't afford to pay a lot of good players to come. So you just have occasional, you have a Beckham and an Henry and a Keane in the glamour franchises, but you don't have real top quality players throughout the league. It's just isolated pockets. And that's because although crowds have gone up, TV money is still paltry and TV audiences are still very small.
Hughie, Beckham, now there's going to be speculation about his future. There inevitably is. And it seems obviously everybody's chiming in. Australia, China, exotic places, Paris Saint-Germain, QPR to play with Harry, Monaco. If you were, or maybe just buying a franchise and being an owner and staying in the U.S., We'll find out from Tom what he's going to do, since Tom knows because he's in the U.S. But before that, excuse me, if you were Beckham's people, what would you suggest he does?
I think a few things are important for Beckham regarding his next move, and the checklist is as follows. It's got to be a nice place. I don't see him going to live in Anzhi, for example. It's got to be a big project, or they can brand it as a project. And I think it's got to, be an element of glamour involved. So somewhere like Monaco, Sydney, possibly one of the big cities in China. He's not going to be much of the Premier League. He'll say the right things and be flattered and sort of, encourage the speculation. But he's not going to come play for QPR.
Why not? There's a chance to play with Harry.
He had the chance to play Harry last year and it didn't take it when Harry was at Tottenham and he trained there. He's always said he doesn't want to play for Liverpool over the Man United, and I
I kind of believe him, frankly. He wanted to have played in the Premier League. He's had countless opportunities to do so earlier in his career. Also, I think it suits him to be slightly... to be playing at a slightly lower level, away from the intense scrutiny he'd get over here. I mean, Tom would tell be a far better judge than I am at the moment about how good he is and how well he's playing and the standard of opponents he's up against. But I don't think at the age of 37 he's really going to be good enough to be playing regularly in the Premier League.
Tom, floor is yours to tell us, to answer Hughie's questions and tell us what you reckon will happen. I'm going to throw in my two cents about Monaco, which is that I think it's more a case of Monaco are owned by a very wealthy Russian who's actually wealthier than Abramovich, according to what you read on the internet, when, of course, the internet never lies. And I think he just wanted to meet David Beckham and chat with him. I don't see him going playing. The French second division is just a bunch of guys running around kicking lumps out of each other. I don't think it's a great place for him to be. That's just my own two cents on the Monaco option. What are you hearing and what do you reckon will happen?
Yeah, well, Beckham himself doesn't seem to know where he's going. He hasn't had any really concrete, certain offers yet. He said he's going to make a decision by Christmas, so he's got a couple of weeks to actually get these offers. It may be that Australia is the most interested place to have him, and the season ends in February, March there, so he could just play for a couple of months there and then go somewhere else, you know, maybe do some kind of Asian tour where he's still incredibly popular. But as Hughie says, Premier League isn't right for him. He's done well in MLS this season, but that's because he's been stepping back, playing the quarterback role, and, you know, rather than running forward, because he can't really run anymore, he's finding space away from goal, back down the pitch, and then playing long balls. If anyone marks him, you know, he's much less effective, and he hasn't got the drive and the energy to get around that. So just all we have to do is close him down, which is going to be no problem in a very physical league like the Premier League. And I think this is why, although top clubs, you know, have been very nice to him, praising him and kind of expressing interest in a sense, they're not going to follow through with that in the cold light of day now that he is available. So he may have to settle somewhere fairly far away from what looks like is going to be his base in West London. And it's be interesting to see if he really wants to do that and if he really has got the stomach to go to Australia or China, where he could earn a fortune, when what he really wants to do is be in Europe.
All right, time now for some quick hits. Clive, Jermaine Defoe scores another two as Spurs roll over Fulham. Don't think anyone expected him to be quite this prolific. Will he keep it up? And if so, what happens to Adebayor?
Yeah, remarkable run of form for the little guy. And to be quite honest, I especially hope he keeps it up by next Sunday.
We know you hope it, but will he?
Yeah, I think he's enjoying his football. He's looking sparkling. He looks like he's going to score every time he gets the ball. He's thriving in this 4-2-3-1 setup, and I think it's important actually that the likes of with Dembele and Sandro and Dempsey, their contributions to that team and that setup is vital. And I think he's thriving off that. And he looks like he's going to score every time he gets the ball, and I think he can thrive in it. Yes, as for Adebayor, he's only got himself to blame for him not being in the team at the moment. And as long as he can, when he comes back. Oh, actually, I think he's going off to the African Nations Cup in January, so...
Bad, Addy, bad. Liverpool squeeze out a 1-0 win over Southampton, but even our own Tony Barrett, no points for guessing which team he has a soft spot for, describes it as unconvincing. Tom, is it weird to you that Liverpool seem to do better when they play badly?
Well, I think they're probably more wasteful than poor against Southampton. But it's not weird when you have a team that's trying to play expansive, more ambitious football and it doesn't yet have the personnel or the practice to do it. It should be inconsistent. You know, teams that are less ambitious and more grinding will probably be more consistent. And also, Liverpool, with their lack of squad depth, you know, are reliant on two men, Gerrard and Suarez. So as they go, so will Liverpool go to a large extent.
And no Suarez next week, no Borini, of course, so we find out who Liverpool's reserve centre forward is. Manchester City escaped Goodison Park with a point. Mancini has a meaningless Champions League game in midweek and United next weekend. That could be the season right there. Matt, would you play the scrubs against Borussia Dortmund and the starters on Sunday? Or is this concept kind of meaningless because sometimes we don't really know who the starters are?
I don't think it'll be the season on Sunday, but yeah, it's a very, very important game. They won't want to fall further behind. And another reason maybe to toss it in on Wednesday against Dortmund is to stay out of the Europa League, which doesn't really have much cachet at the biggest clubs, and also can really wreak havoc with your Premier League challenge sort of back into the season, playing Thursday, Sunday. So I think that would be a smart move by Mancini, yes.
Or maybe not so smart, because part of the reason why City always gets stuck in these very difficult groups is because the UEFA coefficient is low, and that's because, that could come back to haunt you. Speaking of Everton, Davy Moyes complained about the penalty and that Fellaini foul. Or actually, he claims a fourth official said the foul was an Osman, which would have been ridiculous. Now, I'm assuming the fourth official isn't actually insane and was just kind of telling Moyesy whatever he wanted to hear just to get him out of his ear. But what do you make of Moyes' words what do you make of Moyes' contention that was not a foul by Fellaini, which seemed pretty obvious to me, and also his suggestion that City have been, quote, getting a lot of penalties lately? Bit of conspiracy there?
It was a strange thing for Moyes to come up with. I mean, by any definition, that was a foul by Fellaini. But getting back to that thing again about, the shirt pulling tongue and the things in the penalty area, there was a referee who actually gave a foul, for goodness sake. That's what's going to happen. You commit a foul, it goes against you. I'll have to take Moyes' word for it about what the fourth official told him. But the right decision was made, however way you come around to actually making it. City getting a lot of penalties. Got a lot of penalties recently. I think I saw a stat this morning that said in the last couple of seasons they have had more penalties than any other Premier League team. But they attack a lot. They get the ball in the box a lot. They have benefited from a couple of dubious ones of late. I expect the one against Villa the only other week. That was a great bone of contention. But conspiracy theory? No, I don't think so.
So you don't believe that Sheikh Mansour and the Emirati Sovereign Fund have secretly bought the PGM?
Yeah, has he bought some shares in the PGMO? Yeah. No, I don't think so. Not quite
yet. Just checking. Harry Redknapp has already increased QPR's points total by 50% in just two games. Tom, you once, no doubt, worshipped at the altar of Harry. What do you make of his job thus far?
I sort of feel it's harsh to judge Redknapp until he's had the chance to sign at least six players in January. he's operating with one hand tied behind his back when he's not operating during a transfer window. Yeah, all the same, a couple of draws against two of the Premier League's worst teams in Sunderland and Villa unfortunately represents progress for QPR, doesn't it? I'm sure they'll continue to do better under him and get out of it eventually. It's a solid enough start, but too early to tell.
Can I just point out, we've managed to go through the whole show without mentioning Fernando Torres until now and Sunderland until a second ago. Sunderland, who lost again. What is it now? Two wins out of the last 22 for Martin O'Neill. Just wanted to point that out for the record. Not picking anyone. Matt, we've saved the best for last. Arsenal, fan protests, stinky performances. Wenger citing psychological problems, those of his players, not his own. Can you sort out this mess?
Not in 30 seconds and probably not in over the rest of the season. He needs to spend some money, doesn't he? He needs to buy in some better players. There's been a steady decline in the quality of players at Arsenal over the last 5 years. And as a result, they've been a decline in the amount of points they've been collecting. I still think they'll finish fourth. I still think they've got enough, but they desperately need a centre-forward. Selling Van Persie and replacing him with Giroud, Strome, Jovinho was never going to work, and it hasn't done. I think if you look at the amount of goals Arsenal have scored, if you take out the sort of Southampton, Spurs and West Ham games, their goal tally is pitiful. And for all the concerns about the defending and lack of a holding player, I think it's the absence of goals is the real problem.
There you go, Arsenal fans. Vote of confidence from Matt Hughes, fourth place.
One for you, Gab. I didn't read your column last week. Sad admission on the part of the assistant sports editor. What's up with Wesley Snyder?
Well, first of all, I'm offended, given that you edit my column, that you didn't actually read it. But what's going on with Snyder is that he signed this enormous contract in October of 2010 on the back of having led Inter to the treble and a so-so Holland team to the final of the World Cup. Inter decided they want to make cutbacks and they want him to take a pay cut. He makes about 200 grand a week. They basically told him like, oh, well, you know, you can play another year for free, basically, and we won't give you any more money. And he's like, no, that's kind of stupid. I don't really want to take a 30% wage reduction. So they said, all right, well, while you mull over our offer, you won't obviously be paying because you're unsettled by your contractual dispute, which, of course, is a one-way dispute that Inter created. The upshot of this, there's a meeting actually on Monday as we're recording this, which should help determine his future. I think Snyder's being bullied by Inter. But the interesting thing is the guy's still just 28 years old. I think he's got a lot of good football left in him. I hope that he does take a pay cut to play elsewhere if he needs to do, because I want to see him back playing for a big team. And I also think that what Inter is doing is both stupid and counterproductive as well. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts or email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk, as so many of you do every single week. You can go to thetimes.co.uk for your news, your views, your web chats, our blogs. My blog is tomorrow on Tuesday. I know it's a treat for all of you. And also our analysis as well. We're also all on Twitter. Tom, what's your Twitter handle?
@Tom_Dart.
Now, that's the little funny line at the bottom, the underscore. It's not actually, you actually want to write out underscore, because that would be too long, a Twitter handle. Clive, you're on there as well. You're?
CWPW01.
That's, what is it, some kind of weird, like...
It's phonics, man. I've got a small child.
There you go.
Speak now.
That's all we got time for. So thanks for joining us, and until next week. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.